Computer Science 455 on October 6th.
Start this. For the project,
Vic is going to want to talk with you about your project and how it works and all. So I think he's got a sign-up time list here to pass around. Things are sparse, as you see, but we'll at least get a start. So,
yeah.
Any comments?
Just quick. I took kind of three blocks, more times than we need, but sort of a Monday through Friday from 9, just before this class, 9:15 roughly, to just prior to class start, right after this class period, but it's also Monday through Thursday, and then an hour in the afternoon, 1 to 2 Monday through Friday. So I think that covers enough of the week that you should be able to
pick a time. Make a time work.
And if none of those work, then talk to
them. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Vic. I'll get those to you.
Well, I'll be here.
I'll get you the projects this afternoon. Okay. I'll get you the projects this afternoon.
Oh, okay.
Okay. All right. So I guess we'll start with what we got. Nobody said anything. So this is where we stopped last time. And as I said, I'm not really going to talk much about this. In today's internet, the use of the ATM technology is pretty much limited to the backbone circuits that are permanently established between regional and national, local, regional, and national internet providers. You don't see ATM service as a customer usually. Maybe if you're a very large company, you get involved in that, but certainly not as somebody at the endpoints. Anyway, so that was just the background. So we talked last time about virtual circuit networks. We're going to spend the rest of the time on this chapter talking about datagram networks. I think we've said these things before, but it doesn't hurt to review. There's no call setup involved. Every packet every datagram carries its own destination address. The routers in the network don't have to know anything about what's going on overall in the network. Their job is just to forward the packets as they see them. And a consequence of that, if you think about it, is that if you're sending a bunch of datagrams to the same destination, even in a very short period of time, some of them may take different paths. And that's just the way it is. That can lead to packet reordering, as some paths are longer than others. And the network is designed, the datagram network is designed to handle that. So no biggie associated with that. It does raise the question of how does a network router accomplish its job of forwarding? How does that work? I felt like this slide was in a strange place relative to the others, but here it is. Let's see if it has. Yeah. Okay. So in a datagram router, there's no notion of a different forwarding table usually for different input ports, right? Different incoming paths don't have anything to say usually about where the packets have to go. If they're going to a particular destination, they just need to go there. If you introduce things like firewalls and the like, that may change. But the basic idea is that a packet with a particular destination address has to go out a particular link, and it doesn't matter where it came from in order to do that. So in the forwarding table that the router has, there will be address ranges. Oh, all right. Hold on here. The problem is that when I change the display setting, the pen stops working, and then. We have to get back to the right place again. There he is. Okay. What you see here is a common prefix. Common prefix. What do I want to say? Beginning. Do it again. Beginning and ending. That constitute the what the keys are in the address tables, in the forwarding table. So any address that falls in this range needs to go out through interface 1. In this range through interface 2. They better. The ranges can actually overlap, which I think we see on the next slide. And the rule there is that the prefix of the address that is the longest match. So you can see here that we have three different rules. It says if the address looks like this, go out interface 2. If it looks like this, go out interface 1. You see that there's a common prefix of those, but any particular packet that comes in, like this one down here, see, will match up to that rule because this is a prefix of the destination address that matches this rule all the way up to there, and this one. And although it matches, it also matches this one. There's a longer one. Okay. So the rule is longest match, and then all right. So the consequence of this. Yeah, I don't want to go on to that. Darn it. In the wrong place again. The consequence of this forwarding process is that, think about it, think about your data structures class. What sort of data structure would you use to find what sort of data structure would you keep your routing table in to find this longest match? Fast, right? Because you may have to process up to 1,000,000 packets a second. That gives you a microsecond to do every address lookup. Okay, a binary search tree. And in fact, because the keys are all the same size, the way they do it is they just do it based on each bit position in turn. Okay, so are we in the ones? Are we in the zeros? And you get down to this point, and you say, do I have anything that goes on from there? And if so, keep going, keep looking. So that's sort of the classical approach to doing it. In fact, at the speeds that current day routers have to go, they implement those algorithms in hardware so that you can do a very fast lookup on the addresses. It's essentially the same algorithm. It's called a content addressable memory, and that's the kind of they build circuitry to do that kind of lookup. Let me say one other thing. The thing that you can do with the hardware that you can't do easily with the software is you can do all those lookups at once. Right, so you feed in the address you're looking for, and you have the hardware, a bunch of registers, essentially containing the possible matches, and you can look at all of them at once. So it isn't really the same algorithm. Right, you could say, does it and whichever ones match, then you get a hit on maybe several, and then you take the longest one of those. That's okay. So let's delve down inside then the router and look at what goes on. So the first thing that's going on inside the router is that it's participating in these distributed routing algorithms to figure out what its forwarding table ought to be, based on the global state of the network. And then the other thing is it's using them to forward the packets. So we're going to concentrate first on the second part and come back to the first part later. So each network interface typically has an input port and an output port associated with it. And we draw these diagrams like this, but remember that really a network interface is a combination of two of these. There's something on the output side and something on the input side. They end up being sort of ripped apart inside the router, but there's just one place the wire plugs in. Packets arrive on the input ports. They get sent out on the output ports. There's processing associated with the lower level protocol. So there's a physical layer processing that has to happen as part of the input port. There's link layer processing, like for Ethernet. And ultimately, you've pulled apart the packet enough to know what its destination address is. And then you're ready to process it through what's called the switching fabric. And we're going to talk about different kinds of switching fabrics here momentarily. Okay? So that's the overall structure. On the output side, we do the opposite thing of re-encapsulation and so forth. I get ahead of myself here. This is the stuff that was inside that box that I just talked about. Input port. So, what happens? It's easy enough to do this line physical layer processing and the data link layer processing. Not much interesting there. But what happens in this right-hand box starts to get interesting. You've got the destination address. You're able to look it up, and you know where it's going to go now in terms of which output port it's going to. But this switching fabric may not be able to accept all the packets that you want to send to it. And so there may have to be some queuing here to hold on to those packets. And that can lead to some bad stuff, which we'll see here in the next slide or two. There are typically three types of switching fabrics with different performance characteristics, and I think we have diagrams for those two. I don't know if we have a separate one for these two. The idea of a memory-based switching fabric, this is what you would get if you just took a classical PC, say, and used it as a router, and you can do that. Very, very easy to do. It happens in Windows, happens in Linux. Incoming packets get transferred into the main memory of the computer, and then from there into the output port memory. So here's the problem. If you do it that way, think about what you learned in 260 or 234 about how computer science 260 or EE 234 about how a computer is put together. There's typically a system bus, a memory bus, an I/O bus. There are a bunch of buses, which have here been reduced to just a system bus. But the problem is that if you do it with a memory-based switching fabric, the packet actually has to transfer over the system bus twice, or system buses twice. And you know, this is not a time diagram here. This is a physical diagram. What happens in time is that first we transfer over the bus, and then later again we transfer over the bus, and all of the time that we're doing that, the bus is not available for anything else in the system. So the overall ability of a memory switched router is limited by the speed of the system bus, okay. which can only be used sequentially. So the step up from there is a design for the router that doesn't involve that extra trip into system memory. Instead, the bus here is organized in such a way that each of the interface devices to the network can directly determine where the data needs to go to get to the output port, and so the data only crosses the bus once. Okay? So what does it take? What does it mean? It means that the interface devices have to be a lot smarter, because in the previous picture, what would happen is the data would come in through the input port. We wouldn't really have to do anything with it except, from the input port perspective, except put it in the memory of the computer. Then the processor figures out where it's going to go and sends it to the output port. Okay? So the input port can be pretty stupid in that case. Well, unintelligent, shall we say, in that case. Whereas here, if you're going to pull this off, the input ports actually have to be able to do the lookups in the forwarding table directly and send things on their way. Okay? We're still limited by the bus contention, but now we're only going over it one time, so things are... we get a higher capacity router with a given bus speed. And the observation that the authors make is that Cisco and other router manufacturers build bus-based routers that are plenty fast enough at the enterprise level to handle what needs to be done. Okay, so you can, you know, making the bus fast enough, getting the architecture right, you can solve a certain class of problems. So, if you want to go faster than you can with that sort of device, you're talking about moving up to a switching network that has the ability to process multiple packets in parallel. And one example of that is what's known as a crossbar switch, which I've attempted to draw there. And the idea is that at each point, I can't draw there, it doesn't work. At each point, there's a switching element. At each cross point, there's a switching element that can hook those two wires together. Okay, and so in the ideal case, this switching fabric can handle n inputs and n outputs all at the same time, right? And that only occurs in the case that all of the inputs want to go to different destinations. Right? If two inputs want to go to the same destination at the same time, that's not going to work. And so the control of these switching elements has to be sufficiently smart to prevent that from happening, or you end up with just electrical noise on the wires. There are other parallel networks that have been designed for switching that comes out of multiprocessor work. The Batcher-Banyan network is an example of that. That's more of a tree-based network. It doesn't have quite the capacity that this has. But it involves less hardware to achieve that capacity. So, but the basic idea that I want you to get is that an interconnection network goes faster because it has parallel paths in it. Right? That's the key idea. Okay. Well, what happens on the output side then? Remember, we've got potentially a lot of input devices all running at some speed, and it can happen. It can happen that all of those inputs get a packet that needs to go to the same output at the same time. All right, so they all funnel into our one poor little output line here, and obviously, even if these are the same, if the inputs are the same speed as the output, all those packets can't go at once. Right? We have to go only at the rate of the output line. So what does that mean? It means we need buffering. We need buffering on the outputs. And once we have buffering on the outputs, we have the opportunity and the need to choose which of the queued packets get sent first. So that's the idea of a scheduling discipline. Now, there's an obvious choice of first in, first out queuing. And that works pretty well for networks that have best effort service delivery rules like the internet. But there are also queuing disciplines that address the possibility that different packets have different priorities, that different flows have different rate requirements and the like. We'll get to some of these later, I think, when we talk about link layer stuff. Okay? But the point here is just that once you have queuing, you have the opportunity to choose what goes next. Right? And that's called the scheduling discipline. Well, once also you have queuing, you have the possibility that the available queue space overflows, and in that case you get losses. Okay. Not surprising. And you have queuing delay. No surprise. This is a throwaway slide. You don't have to remember this. This is all very speculative. Some people have done some research to say how much buffering do you need, but nobody has explained to me what the definition of need is. so therefore, I'm considering it a throwaway slide. But notice that say for a typical internet round trip time, that's maybe even a little low, you might need 300 megabytes of buffer for a single output link. That's quite a bit. There have been some more recent work that says the more connections you have, the less buffering you need. I have no intuition whatsoever about that, about why that would be true. Somebody might want to do a little extra credit paper, taking into account what that has to say and the more recent research. Both of these are referenced in the book. So if you're in need of extra credit, that's something that I'd be curious in knowing more about, and you can tell me. Right? But it's not part of the exam, definitely. Okay, well, it gets worse. if the switch fabric itself is not fast enough to keep up with all of the inputs, remember we said when we looked at that crossbar, we said if there were two inputs, the input packets that wanted to go to the same output packet at the same output port at the same time, that wouldn't work. So this is mostly a question of the speed of the switch fabric related to the input speeds. And so we've got two packets going to the same destination. We can't send them both at once. One of them has to wait. That means input queuing. Right? So not only do we need output queuing because we can go faster than the output links, we also need input queuing if we can go faster than the switch fabric. And one of the problems that occurs when you have input queuing is that can you see that there's a green arrow here that goes over to the middle box? the red packet wants to go to the top box, and the blue packet wants to go to the middle to the bottom box. If the queuing works out such that the red packet up in this top box is chosen rather than the one down here, the one down here has to wait. Of course, right? Makes sense. The problem is that with queues as implemented, with FIFO queues at least, as implemented in at least some switches, that could cause a later packet, that this green one, that could be delivered to actually not be able to go due to a phenomenon called head-of-line blocking. That's what I meant to say. Okay? So the red one can't go, neither can the green one. To overcome that, people have come up with various schemes for ensuring that you can get a packet out of the queue even if the head packet is blocked. But of course, the whole question here is, are the dollars for the circuitry to do this worth it? That's what it boils down to. And so a lot of modeling of performance occurs, a lot of cost evaluation occurs, and then it becomes a business decision about whether you put that in your switch or not to overcome that. Okay. I'm going to stop now because that's the end of the sort of switching piece of this. Any questions about those guys? But yeah, go ahead.
What kind of hardware do like a typical wireless router you buy for most homes use?
What does a wireless router for most homes use? It will use the first one, the memory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in order to get those other features, you can buy a $2,000 router.
Probably at least, yeah. That might get you up to the bus based one. To get to the switching fabric based router, you're probably $10,000 and up. Maybe significantly up, because they're going to be the ones that are used in the network backbones with lots of very high speed. And you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, if you sell routers, you know, that's a very significant chunk of money. For the customer of such a router, a single router is probably not a very significant part of their overall operation, because they're spending hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars a month on the links. Right? So the links probably far dominate the router costs. The individual router costs. Now the router costs overall, they'll try to optimize those. Okay, so we're going to dive now into the internet's network layer and talk about how that works. The key element, I would say, is the IP protocol. That's the sort of core part of the design here that everything else is derived from. You decide, we've decided about this, and then we have to figure out other things to make it work. But this is the key intellectual idea that we'll have 4-byte host addresses, that we will use datagrams, and so on and so forth, and that there'll be a particular header format. Once you make that decision, it isn't hard to come up with what the forwarding table needs to say, but figuring out a way to get it to say that is the job of the routing protocols. Okay, so we'll talk about those in some depth. And finally, also operating at the network layer is this internet control message protocol. Internet control message protocol. Yeah, I think that's all it is. Well, IP. Right. The internet protocol protocol. Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah, all right. Got it. So this operates also over the top of IP. True? No. This is another network layer protocol. It's not over top of IP. Works similarly, and the forwarding rules are similar enough that we don't need a separate set of forwarding tables. But this is a management protocol for sort of keeping the network working well, letting hosts know when they've done things that are not going to succeed. You know, if you try to ping a host that isn't there, somebody should probably tell you that. Try to connect to a host that isn't there. That's the job of ICMP. Okay. So, remember that below this, below here, there's going to be a transport header. Followed by the application data. But from the point of view of IP, none of that matters. We don't care about that content at all. We put on our IP header, 20 bytes, and the network layer will take care of getting this datagram where it needs to go. Nice idea. What's in it? The IP version number is 4 these days, and someday, we've been saying for the last 20 years, it will be 6. does seem to be getting closer, but at a slow rate. The header length, we had a similar thing in TCP. Because there are IP layer options that may be present, you have to say how many bytes of header there are, so you know where the transport header begins. Type of service, not used very much these days, but again, more and more. Real-time traffic with high priority can be indicated in there, but it hasn't really permeated the internet yet. The overall length of the datagram, I think this is often redundant with information that's provided at the link layer, but it's handy, and I guess they felt it was worth spending 2, at the time, rather precious bytes to do. Okay, so that's the basic stuff. Then comes stuff that's related to sort of managing overall traffic. One of the problems that occurs is IP is specified to be able to carry datagrams up to 64K bytes, which you can tell by that length field right there, being 16 bits, 64K bytes, but many of the link layers over which it operates can't carry datagrams that are that big. So to handle that, a process called fragmentation has been designed into the IP layer that lets the components at the network layer rip apart a big packet and send it as much smaller packets. It's called fragmentation. We're going to talk about how it works. And in order to pull that off, we just needed to have these fields here, which I'll talk about here in a moment. Next word. The time to live field is set at the beginning when the packet is first sent. And as it propagates through the network, it gets decreased. I think originally this was intended to be a time to live measured in, with a time dimension. But the thing that worked and was figured out 20 plus years ago was rather it's the number of hops that the packet is allowed to make between routers before it gets to its destination. So every time a packet goes through a router, this time to live field gets decreased by one, and if it ever gets to be zero, the packet is discarded. And the router sends back an ICMP message saying network not reachable, right? At least with that. It sends back time to live expired. Network not reachable is something else. Okay. So this is this next field is interesting. This has to do with the demultiplexing behavior of IP. You can have many different transport layers running on top of IP. Which one should handle the encapsulated packet? Well, IP has to know. It has to know, the IP layer code has to know which upper layer code is going to get this. So we had a similar phenomenon in UDP and TCP, right? We had the port numbers for demultiplexing. Here we have a identifier for the next upper protocol. So it might be TCP, it might be UDP, it might be SCTP. Any of those transport layer protocols might be identified here at the upper layer. Okay. We only do a checksum on the header in IP at the IP layer, and the only reason for doing it was to avoid having bad packets running around in the network. Packets that couldn't go anywhere, right? Source address, destination address, and then the options. So why the source address? Why do you think we must?
For return address?
Well, yeah, could be. But if the application really cared, or the transport layer really cared, it could have been put there. I think the main reason is so that errors can be reported, right? Like the time to live exceeded. That needs to operate at the IP layer. Oh yeah, it's used to make sure that packets don't get injected in the network and live forever.
Okay. So if you ever wanted, deliver something that didn't want to do it, just expose it, you'd be out of luck.
You're out of luck, just out of luck.
Not very likely.
Yeah, probably not. I think I think these days, sort of 30-ish, maybe, is as much as you see.
Starting with like 16, and that started failing.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
So, yeah. It's
initial default, I believe.
Uh-huh. So I think the default these days is probably 50 or 60, 64 maybe. We'll look at Wireshark at some point here, and we'll be able to see what those things say. All right. So why fragmentation? I said the link layers may not support. As big a packet as IP supports, so the IP layer becomes responsible for doing fragmentation of those big packets, and at the final destination, only at the final destination do they get reassembled at the network layer now, by the IP layer, before being handed to the transport protocol. Why only at the final destination? Let's think about that. What behaviors have we seen in the network layer that suggest that this is a good decision? Okay, right. So one reason would be if we're putting it back together only to refragment it. Farther down the road. What does it take time-wise and resource-wise to do fragmentation? Well, you have to hold to do defragmentation. You have to hold on to all the pieces long enough and wait for the last piece to arrive, right? And that means you have to match up later arriving pieces with earlier arriving pieces. The routers have too much work to do already. They don't need to take on voluntary work like this, is another reason. And finally, remember that the service model of IP allows for only best effort delivery. So some fragment may never show up at some router. How long do you have to wait for it to show up becomes a question. It just may never show up. And even if that doesn't happen, even if it's not lost, it may take a different path. It may never pass through this router. So again, how long do you wait before, and what do you do when you give up? Well, you go ahead and send on the fragments. So all in all, reassembly is not worth doing in the routers. Now, in IP version 6, they took this a step farther and said, you know what? It's not even worth doing fragmentation in the routers at all. We're going to instead report back to the source what the maximum size it's allowed to send is, and make it do the fragmentation. Okay, so we still do fragmentation in IP version 6, but only at the source, reassembly only at the destination. IPv4 lets the routers do fragmentation. Okay, so how does it work? suppose we're trying to send 4,000 bytes, but the maximum transmission unit, that's the biggest thing that the link layer can carry, is 1500. We're going to split it up into into fragments. And then in the this is the IP header now. Write this on here. And this is the IP header. the original IP header. So what do? We chop it up into chunks that are at most 1,500 bytes long. We assign a identifier. I think it's done more or less randomly. We assign an identifier to it. We set the fragment flag, which, and the meaning of the fragment flag really is more coming, more frags coming. When it's set, and we set the offset field for each of the fragments. Notice that the offset field is measured in 8-byte chunks. So 8 times 185 is 1,500, maybe? No, probably it's 1,480. Yes, it says so right here, 1,480. Because notice the packet actually gets a little bigger because we add an IP header for each fragment. So we can only handle 1,480 bytes out of the original 4,000 with each fragment. And so when we get to the last fragment, the frag flag is zero. It says this is the last one. So a normal packet that hasn't been fragmented will just have offset zero and frag flag zero. Okay. And if it has been fragmented, the frag flag will be one. I'm over. Sorry. Thank you for your patience. We will continue next time with addressing schemes.